This is Stefan Camp on KBOO with Political Perspectives. Joining me in the studio today is Joseph Stiglitz. He's the Nobel Prize-winning economist and the author of Globalization and Its Discontents, and most recently, Free Fall, A Look at the Current Financial Crisis. He's also a professor at Columbia University. In his new book, Stiglitz avoids the standard excuses for the economic meltdown. It was freak bad luck, or it was the result of greed on Wall Street alone. Instead, he says, the cause of the crisis was a combination of many factors, including poor regulation, too much debt, speculation, a hunger for short-term gains. The list goes on. Professor Stiglitz, welcome to KBOO.
Nice to be here.
Your book is called Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. It's about what you call the Great Recession of 2008, which we're still feeling now. It joins dozens of books that have already been written about this crisis, but I'm wondering what it's like to essentially write history as it's happening.
That's a really good question, and was one of the challenges in writing the book. But in a way, this book is very different from the many other books that have been written. Most of those are journalistic accounts of the 4 days that Bear Stearns collapsed, or the 4 days that Lehman Brothers was in trouble. They describe what happened, who said what to whom, what would have happened if the guy hadn't had to go to the bathroom at the critical moment in the negotiations. My book is really about the battle of ideas, how particular ideas contributed to the flawed policies that led to the crisis, how they helped shape the response, a response that clearly has been inadequate, which is why the crisis has continued as long as it has, and hopefully the kinds of lessons that we will take away from the Great Recession of 2008 and the kind of vision that we should have going forward.
Back in the summer of 2007, I remember I was stopped at a traffic light on Woodlawn Avenue in Chicago, and I was about a block away from Barack Obama's house at the time, and on the radio, the new Fed president, Ben Bernanke, was talking about the economy, and the hosts were debating whether it might be time to break out the R word, recession. What was your thinking around that time, and how early did you predict some kind of a crisis?
Well, actually, I began to get very concerned about the economy in 2005 and 2006. I saw the bubble forming. It seemed to me that this what was happening was unsustainable. Most Americans' income was going down, and that was particularly true at the bottom. And yet the prices of houses for those at the middle and the bottom were skyrocketing. And you didn't have to be a genius to figure out that that pattern was not sustainable. The moment the interest rates rose from their very low level that they were at the time that Greenspan had brought them down, there would be trouble. There was an occasion in the January of 2007 when I was in Davos, which is the annual meeting of a lot of business leaders, government leaders in Switzerland. And I was in the uncomfortable position of giving my forecast of where the economy was going to go in 2007. And I pointed out that in 2005 and 2006, I had forecast that this bubble couldn't go on, and it had gone on. And I said, well, there are two alternatives. Either the theory, the arguments that I put forward were wrong, and maybe it could go on. Or the alternative was that because it had gone on so long, when it finally broke, the disaster that would follow would be all the worse. And of course, I suggested that I thought that it was just a matter of time before the bubble broke and before we would have to confront these problems. And unfortunately, that proved to be the case.
And I do detect a certain element of I told you so, not to criticize, in your work. And it seems, by and large to me, like you do have common sense on your side. I read this stuff and it's not hard to swallow. But the things you're saying are still anathema to the current accepted wisdom. And I'm wondering if you feel like you're speaking it all from an outside perspective, or if people just aren't listening to you, or Anything like
that? Well, there's a beginning of a change in views, but that's why I wrote the book in a way, because it is this battle of ideas. There were a whole group of people, influenced very much by Wall Street, who believed that markets were always efficient. And if you believe that markets are always efficient, you can't have bubbles. And if you can't have a bubble, why do anything about the bubble? The advocates of these views included not only Greenspan, but Bernanke and some people in the current administration. And these, you might call them free marketeers, were very active in stripping away regulations and resisting all the attempts that were being made to adopt new regulations for the dangerous new products that were coming on, the credit default swaps, the derivatives. I think you might say the good news is that it's beginning to seep on more and more people that view is wrong. One of the things I point out in my book, Free Fall, is that if you're too big to fail, you're really too big to be. These too big to fail banks have a one side bet. If they gamble and win, they walk off with the profits. If they lose, the taxpayer picks up the losses. That distorts incentives. It also creates an unlevel playing field. The too big to fail banks can get capital at a lower cost because anybody providing capital knows that there is no downside risk. The government will bail them out. And we've made the problem so much worse by the way we've handled this bailout. So to me, it was very good news that President Obama said that we need to do something about the too big to fail banks to at least tax them to offset some of the advantage, unfair advantage that they have.
You're listening to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM. My name's Stefan Camp, and this morning on Political Perspectives, I'm speaking with Joseph Stiglitz. Professor Stiglitz, I would like to ask you a little bit about ownership. Particularly, the American taxpayer now, after the bailouts, has a very large stake in some very large companies like General Motors and the insurance giant AIG. What does this mean for our society?
As the U.S. government becomes the owner, not only of General Motors, Chrysler, but of many of the banks, financial institutions, there arises, what does it mean as an owner to be a socially responsible owner? We talk a lot about corporate social responsibility, but now that we are the owners of these firms, what does that mean? And some very interesting examples of that. AIG, we own 80% of AIG. If it weren't some accounting problems, we'd own 100% because we really bailed it out. If it hadn't been for our action, it would be dead. But then the way AIG has behaved since is hardly a model corporation. It pays out huge bonuses when there are seemingly no profits. Does that make sense? Or even more concern is, there is evidence that the AIG has been involved in a large number of deceptive tax evasion practices. Now, what does it mean for a government-owned company to be evading taxes? We should feel very disturbed about it. And yet, it is acting, in some of these cases, as if it were just an ordinary company. Maybe we should insist that when we own a company, it ought to behave in a socially responsible way, a transparent way, so that the owners can see what is going on. And maybe it should be setting a new level of transparency, corporate social responsibility. Unfortunately, with the U.S. Treasury as the effective owner, it seems to have gone on acting in many of the same irresponsible ways that got us into the trouble in the first place.
What's a first step that we can take towards reforming these kind of practices?
In a way, it's not that complicated. What we want from our financial system is to allocate capital, manage risk, provide capital to new enterprises to help create jobs, to run the payment mechanisms, and to do all this at low cost. because we were paying so much attention to what the big banks wanted, we just responded. You might call it political expediency. It was the demands of the big bankers. Many of these banks don't provide very much credit. They're not in the credit business. They're not in the lending business. They're in the trading, speculating business. And that's where they started making money once again. And it was the basis of the speculation that has led to the big bonuses. If we have begun by asking the question I just asked, what is it that we want, we would have given the bailout money in a very different way. We would have put conditions on the money as we bailed out the banks. And politically, my view is that would have been much better for President Obama, because now what we see is the economy is not recovered. He knows, and everybody else knows, that we need more money to get the economy fully in recovery. But Americans are angry. Americans are angry because what they see is all this money going out and unemployment going up. And one has to try to explain to them, well, there were two programs. Part of it was to bail out the banks. That was not done very well. We apologize, but that was really started under President Bush. The other part was our initiative. That was a stimulus that worked. We made one mistake. We made it too small. And as a result, unemployment is lower today. If we hadn't done it, unemployment would have been 12%. That would have been a disaster. It's only 9.7%. That's still a disaster, but it's better than 12%. So the stimulus worked, but it was just too small. So there's a sense in which sometimes I think politicians, in doing what they think is the politically expedient thing, they actually, it's bad politics. Because in the long run, those things often don't work, and voters figure that out, and that constrains future actions.
You mentioned that the free fall from which your book takes its title is essentially over, but things will probably not get better for quite some time. And in a couple places, you raise the possibility of a system quite different from what we know now in the future. Less spending, less home ownership, things like that. How far can it go? What kind of overhaul could we be looking at here?
Well, I think it's clear that what we were doing before was not sustainable. It was not economically sustainable. It was not environmentally sustainable. It was not sustainable in many ways. And therefore, we can't go back to the world as it was in 2007. The very fact that it led to a savings rate of zero is an example of a consequence that was not sustainable. It was based on many American families living beyond their means and the country as a whole living beyond its means. So that means we have to rethink our economic model. Now, every once in a while, you hear something from the administration or somebody from Wall Street saying, the American consumer is back, and a moment of jubilation. Well, it's not going to happen, because the American consumer was consuming so much based on this belief that the bubble was going to go on forever. But we shouldn't even hope that he comes back, because, as I said, it was a kind of pattern of organization of economy that was not viable for the long run, not viable for our planet. So what we have to do is rethink what it is that we want and how do we get there. Part of the thing that we need to do is invest more in technology, education, infrastructure, make sure that we do something about the growing inequalities that have marked our society. The fact is that even when we were seemingly doing well in the early years of this decade before the crisis, most Americans were doing not so well. Real income of most Americans was actually lower in 2008 than it was in 2000. So these are just an example of a number of the problems that have to be addressed. When I try to lay out in free fall some of the ways in which we can try to address those problems.
All of the consumer spending that was just sort of prolonging this crisis or ignoring it would go towards the GDP, and you raise issue with the GDP. essentially, as I understand it, a measure of all the economic transactions that happen in the U.S. in a given year. For example, we spend much more on healthcare than other developed countries do. That boosts the GDP. What are some alternatives for measuring economic success?
Well, I chaired an international commission on the measurement of economic performance and social progress. And that was exactly the question that we addressed. It's a very important issue, as I point out in Freefall, because what we measure affects what we do. If we measure the wrong thing, we'll do the wrong thing. And it was always recognized that GDP was a measure of market activity, not a measure of well-being. But increasingly, there's been a confusion between those two. And it's increasingly being used as a measure of well-being, not just a market activity. You gave one very good example of what was wrong with that measure, that it measures, in the case of healthcare and government and other sectors, input, not output. We should be measuring performance, not input. The fact that we had to spend so much more to get so much less added to our GDP, in fact, it should have subtracted. Another example, the United States excels in one other area, the fraction of the population that's in prison. And some states are now spending as much or more on prisons as they are in universities. Well, it's very hard to say that that is a mark of a well-being. And yet, all that spending on prisons, which doesn't obviously add to the well-being of those in prison, is added to GDP when it really doesn't measure any aspect of a broad sense of societal well-being.
You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Stefan Camp, and I'm speaking today with Joseph Stiglitz, the world-renowned economist and author of the new book, Free Fall, about the recent economic crisis and what may have caused it. Joseph Stiglitz, you were chief economist at the World Bank from 1997 to 2000, and that's an international institution led by someone from the United States that provides loans to developing countries. And I'm wondering if during your time there, did you see anything that served as a warning of the crisis to come?
There were many aspects of this crisis that reminded me of what I had seen in other countries in crisis. The example of Argentina, where its excessive debt dependence had fueled consumption, and it was only a matter of time before a day of reckoning. When I looked at so many of American consumers, there was the similar kind of pattern. There was something other, another example I mentioned in my book, Freefall, and that is as the crisis unfolded and the banks faced problems. The banks were, in many cases, essentially bankrupt because they had lent on the basis of bubble prices. And when the prices came back to reality, many of the loans would not be repaid. And when loans aren't repaid, a bank is in trouble. What I've seen in so many other cases is that in that midst of that turmoil, the bankers who were the source of the problem, used the chaos surrounding the crisis to effectively steal large amounts of money from the public. As the crisis began, I said to myself, I hope that doesn't happen here, but I'm worried. And then when Hank Paulson submitted this three-page bill to Congress asking for a $700 billion blank check with no congressional oversight and no judicial review, I felt I was back in a banana republic. I said, even most developing countries would not make it so transparent that there was about to be a massive theft. They would at least make some pretense of oversight and judicial review. The bank's incentives, or the banker's incentives, was to take that money, pay it out as fast as they could in the form of dividends and bonuses. And money going out of the banks is not there to be lent, not there to recapitalize the banks, not there to make the banks sounder.
You call this a made in the USA, made in America crisis. If there's such an imbalance in our system of incentives, if there's such miscalculation in where the rewards go, how can we still have so much influence, and how did we bring the rest of the world down with us?
First, our influence has been diminished. During the days that I was chief economist of the World Bank and in the subsequent years, often I would see our Secretary of Treasury or other American officials go around to India, China, to other developing countries and pontificate, you might say, advise these countries. And what they would say is, we think you should do things like deregulate your financial sector, liberalize your financial sector. What they were saying is, do like we have done, and eventually you will be rich, maybe not quite as rich as us, but you will, your economy will grow. If the Secretary Treasurer did that today, he would be laughed at. No one wants to follow America's example. And that's important because that has really markedly diminished our influence. Because we had persuaded so many countries to strip away their regulations, it was easier for the U.S. to export toxic mortgages. After all, the bankers in other countries weren't looking at them and saying, are these products safe for human consumption? They weren't asking, were these the kind of things that our citizens should have? In fact, we exported about 40% of our toxic mortgages. You can imagine how much worse our economic downturn would have been had we not done that. So I jokingly say that we should send a thank you note to the Europeans and to others who've bought our toxic mortgages, who bought into this philosophy of deregulation, because it softened the blow here. But after we exported our flawed philosophy, after we exported our toxic mortgages, we then exported our recession. And so this recession that began in the United States has now become a global recession. The world fell down together. The interesting thing is the recovery is not quite symmetric. Asia followed the kinds of recipes that we give, we advise in our standard textbooks. They had a massive Keynesian stimulus, China particularly, and the result of that is their growth slowed, but only to around 8 or 9%.
And by Keynesian stimulus, you mean the government spending money to get the people to spend money, essentially?
Exactly. And they used it not for consumption, but for investment, to create a high-speed, environmentally sound railroad, national railroad system, for instance, that will increase their income for years to come.
You say that trust is the grease that makes a society function, and especially toward the end of your book, you mentioned the value of community and trust. And for example, the guy who used to give you the mortgage a couple decades ago was somebody in your neighborhood who would have an interest in you not going through foreclosure. But markets seem, even in a functional society, to be cold and calculating just by nature. And I'm wondering how much room really is there for these emotional, moral qualities.
Well, I remain a little bit optimistic. I would say cautiously optimistic. You know, after all, most people working in firms are people. And they have families, they have children, and their children, for instance, tell them about the environment. And they say, we don't want to inherit a world that you've spoiled. And so, you know, person by person, their behavior gets affected. So that's the optimistic note. The American economy, the world economy is being at a near-death experience. And I say, you know, that people that you know have been through a near-death experience often sit back and say, what do I really care about? What's really important? And it's a moment in which they reexamine their lives. Well, I think this is a moment where we should be reexamining our economy and our society. I hope that after this reexamination, that we will redirect some of our efforts. It will require, I think, changing some of our laws, because as much as I would like to believe that trust would work, it works for some, but not for all. We can't rely on the invisible hand to make sure that everything works well. But perhaps in some other areas, we can get a broader consensus about what is decent behavior, and the result of that is that even when there aren't laws, people act in ways that reflect this kind of trust.
Well, we should probably wrap up the interview on that slightly optimistic note, given that the subtitle of your book is America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. I hope it doesn't sink all the way. Joseph Stiglitz, thank you very much for coming by KBOO today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Joseph Stiglitz, world-renowned economist. This interview was recorded in late February when he was in town to speak at the World Affairs Council and stopped by our studios. I'm Stefan Kamp for Political Perspectives. Thank you very much. See you next time.
Got my pockets full of money, I'm gonna spend it all tonight. I got my pockets full of money, I'm gonna spend it all tonight. A whole month's salary, I'm gonna set it to flames on some girl I just met recently. I barely know her name. Take me someplace decent, where we meet up with your friends, where the people are pleasant, where the music never ends.